A short time later, Trader climbed up the ladder to the roof of the MCP and looked over the troops assembled in the cavern, all of whom stared up at him expectantly. Abe, Poet, and Ryan were right in front. Of the 70 or so people present, 46 had been hand-picked by Trader to man the convoy. Drivers, gunners, mechanics. This convoy was going to be one of the biggest he'd organized to date. He was taking 7 transport wags, each with crews of 3, and 4 war wags, each with crews of 5, plus the MCP, which carried 10 people. The rest of the men and women standing around were mostly mechanics and laborers. Their job was to cobble together working wags from the buried Predark fleet. Because the vehicles had been stored for more than a century, their drive systems had to be completely disassembled, cleaned, re-greased, and reassembled before they could be started up. Spare parts and replacement wags for his convoys had never been a problem. But fuel, now that was the problem. Before the new cost, the cavern had had its own gasoline reservoir, meant to supply the entire fleet for decades. But the earthquake that had partially collapsed its roof had also breached the fuel bladder. Most of it had leaked away into the subsoil beneath the cavern long before he and Marcia discovered the place. As a result, Trader was always looking for new, untapped sources of gasoline, but he hadn't found any close to the cavern site. He usually ended up dealing with a middleman, like Baron Lundquist Zeal.
All right! Anybody that's got cold feet about this run can stay here. I won't think the worst of you, and you got my word on that. Of course, if anybody backs out, they'll miss their share of the profits for the whole circuit.
Abe's eyes widened, and his jaw dropped. Trader had been setting up this trip for more than 6 months, taking orders from Vills along the proposed route, and he'd be moving goods looted from stockpiles and goods traded from Vills all through the east. He expected to come back after 3 months with a tidy profit, which was always divided by shares among those who took the risk and went along. Anybody staying behind was going to pay a big-time penalty.
Anybody got any questions? Now's the time to ask them.
A few people gave him hard looks. Most didn't look at him at all. They looked at one another or at the ground. If there was tension in his crew, Trader knew it was largely his fault. He'd been pushing them extra hard to get the convoy prepared for the delivery at Virtue Lake. Prepared, in the case of the madman Lundquist Zeal, meant adding the booby traps and other tricks. The Ville was notorious as a den of killers and thieves. Yet Trader was still willing to do business there because Zeal had agreed to pay top price for the load of new weapons in pure gold, which he had collected in exchange for his gasoline. Gold was good because it was easily portable and everybody wanted it. Many Vills had their own local jack, but gold was still a standard. In the case of Virtue Lake and its baron, big risk equaled big profit. The risk was why he was taking all 4 of his operational war wags to defend the convoy.
Anybody who's supposed to go that wants out, step over by the far wall right now.
Nobody moved.
Well, if that's it, then break time's over. Let's get cracking. I want to be rolling in 18 hours.
Baron Lundquist Zeal thrust his bare foot under Doc Tanner's nose. The old man stared at the appendage, which in the past 2 months had countless times booted him around the perimeter of that very room. Staring at the symbol and the instrument of his oppression, Doc felt suddenly giddy. He also felt a powerful urge to open his mouth and apply his strong, white, even teeth to said foot, to bite off one of the toes that had made his life such a torment and misery. He could almost feel the bone breaking between his incisors, dry and crisp.
Well, what are you waiting for, Tanner? Kiss it, you worthless old bastard!
As Doc drew back, he stifled the urge to gag at the pervasive odor, which wasn't unlike an overripe Stilton cheese. Gagging was another crime against the Baron's person. In the presence of Zeal's exposed foot, anything but total adoration was punishable by a sound and prolonged beating.
Oh, yeah, you know, I think the geezer's getting to like it. Pretty soon he'll be licking your feet like a real squirmy bitch dog.
As far as the humbly kneeling Theophilus Tanner was concerned, Zeal and Shabazz represented the twin poles, the positive and negative, the yin and yang of evil. Shabazz was big and brutish, a bullying braggart. He had a great sprouting black beard and dense black hair, which was coiled in a thick braid at the back of his head. He was a ham-fisted animal with a single remarkable gift. He had a surprisingly inventive mind for torture. Baron Zeal, on the other hand, was tall and slightly built, with an overlarge head, narrow shoulders, and long, spindly legs. His naturally skeletal appearance was made even more horrifying by his reliance on eyeshadow and rouge, which he used in liberal quantities. The Baron's power came not from physical strength, which he largely lacked. He relied instead on his cunning, absolutely ruthless brain, and a genius for manipulation and unlawful acquisition. He used greedy thugs like Shabazz to accomplish his ends, playing them like hand puppets.
Is Shabazz right, Tanner? Are you having fun yet?
Oh, Lord!
Speak up!
Forgive me, noble sir, but I am overjoyed to the point of speechlessness.
Doc suffered their taunts with a lowered head. He was caught in a nightmare from which he couldn't awake. Or perhaps more precisely, caught in an unending series of different nightmares. Like boxes within boxes, when he escaped one horror, he found himself trapped in an even more unpleasant circumstance. Of late, he had endured an unbroken string of keepers, inquisitors, torturers. Some had appeared in the guise of science, a discipline in which the university had well grounded Doc. Others were more like Levi Shabazz, with no guise at all, something to which his matching, splinted little fingers could attest. Though Doc didn't look physically older than 70, chronologically he was more than 200 years old, having been born on Valentine's Day of 1860. The nightmare had begun when he had been forcibly kidnapped, ripped bodily from the bosom of his family, and without so much as a by your leave, pulled forward in time to the year 1998. Doc arrived in the future with his keen mind intact, retained his understanding of the philosophy of science, which he discovered hadn't changed substantially since the time of Newton and Descartes. Science as philosophy involved the asking of carefully worded questions. Doc's habit of answering his captors' questions with questions of his own proved most annoying to them. Their supposedly objective scientific interrogations often took the form of violent arguments, and ended with Doc locked up in solitary confinement. Doc was familiar with the type of investigator Operation Kronos recruited. Similar persons, arrogant, insensitive, cruel, convinced of the righteousness of their cause, had existed in his own time. Such a mindset, it seemed, was an affliction of the well-educated as well as the ignorant. In the end, the Whitecoats tired of his truculence, and to be rid of him, with as much care and consideration as they had shown when they had plucked him from the bosom of his family, they hurled him further forward in time, to the post-Holocaust future and the hell on Earth called Deathlands.
Come on, out with it!
In a universe of wretched feet, of abject, unworthy, bunion-bound dogs that stumble from here to there, misshapen, spavined, graceless, I find no counterpart to the exquisite sculptures now before me, hewn by some now nameless Grecian master, no doubt inspired by a holy vision to construct from perfect alabaster the feet of Apollo. Heavenly Baron, would that my humble tongue your Gemini deities bay.
Oh, Lord, where does he come up with this shit?
You know, I think you're right, Shabazz. I think the old triple stoop's gone and fallen in love with my foot.
The Baron put his shoe back on. Like its maid, it was a red satin pump with a 4-inch heel. The man's taste in footwear had struck Doc as strange when he'd first arrived at Virtue Lake, but he had quickly grown used to seeing the Baron clunk about his big house in pre-dark women's high-fashion shoes.
Now, old man, let's have the song about Spearpoint.
It was the one entertainment that the Baron never tired of, perhaps because it was less a ballad than an inventory of projected spoils. When Doc had first fallen into the hands of these twin demons, he had been in a terribly confused state. Unsure of whom or what he was talking to, he knew only that he was in pain, and he had made certain unfortunate admissions about where he had come from and how he had traveled from there to Virtue Lake. The admissions had prompted Zeal and Shabazz to spend the next week or so torturing him to get the full truth. So many times had he been forced to recite the same series of facts that as a survival mechanism, his mind had formed them into a kind of mnemonic sequence. He could recall the details without thinking about them, even in his sleep, or when otherwise thoroughly confused.
Those who brought on Armageddon planted a seed a century ago, in the months before their science turned God's glorious green earth into a ball of dust. Perhaps they had had a premonition of what was to come. A middle-of-the-night awakening, drenched in cold sweat. Perhaps it was a decision based on mathematical probabilities. Perhaps it was nothing more than a make-work social welfare project. Whatever the cause, the men and women in power took this precious seed and pressed it deep in the largest cave they could find, where it still awaits the nourishing light of day. On this secret sleeping spindle, the future enemies of freedom were to be skewered. Friends, I give you Spearpoint, the locus of the rebirth of the United States of America. 1,000 transport wags with spare parts, 1,000 armored wags with cat tracks, cannons, and electrically fired machine guns, an ocean of fuel and lubricating oil, enough 5.56-millimeter automatic rifles and 9-millimeter pistols and ammunition to equip an army of 50,000 and keep it in the field for a decade. Food, water, and emergency medical supplies for the troops. Automated manufacturing plants and agricultural stations, which combined can feed, clothe, and house up to 1 million people. A fully self-contained and nuclear-powered biosphere with EM blast-shielded electronics and computer systems, all staged and ready to link with any and all artificial satellites still in orbit. And if none are available, the capacity to launch its own surveillance satellites at the touch of a button. This same system can target and launch stored intercontinental ballistic missiles with multiple thermonuclear warheads.
Hey, yeah! All right.
Very nice, I must say. You put some real feelings into it this time, especially the part about the arsenal. Shabazz, just think what we could do with all those war wags and blasters. We could roll over this place like a plague of locusts, taking whatever we want and burning the rest to the ground.
Yeah, rebuild America, my ass.
And I've always wanted to nuke the shit out of something.